So that's the title of the talk today, and I'm with Theory Group at Trimmer. And so the basic outline of the talk I'm going to do is I want to give you some sort of feeling for essentially what the state of play is with the Randall-Sundrum models. The Randall-Sundrum models have been around for quite a while now. There's been, whether you've been involved in it or not, we noticed a massive amount of work done on these models. And so I just want to give some sort of overview for the kind of features that these models have, why people think they're interesting, and in particular, what problems they have. The problems that come up inevitably lead to certain modifications, and I want to discuss some of them. So in particular, after I describe the Randall-Sundrum model to some extent, I'll introduce something called the Little Randall-Sundrum model, and then I'll go to talk about some more exotic sort of extensions of the Randall-Sundrum model, where you imagine that the Randall-Sundrum type scenario is embedded in a high-dimensional space-time. So I'll touch briefly on the notion of multiple walking and on a model called the RX6. Okay, so the basic setup in the Randall-Sundrum model is as follows. In the Randall-Sundrum model, space-time is postulated to be five-dimensional. The fifth dimension, for our purposes today, you can just think of an interval. In practice, it's generated by all the folding out some circle. And the metric is assumed to take some non-factorizable form. So here, y, labels the extra dimension going from 0 to L. And there's also a conformal version of the coordinate of the metric you can write down, but in the talk today I'm going to use this y coordinate version. So the model proceeds to be developed by assuming the surface x sources. And you can say, all right, well, we can assume some background energy in the bulk of this space-time. And you want the four-dimensional theory to preserve a gradient variance. So the most general sort of background source you can imagine would have identical values in the four-dimensional space, but in principle something would be different in the four-dimensional space. So this is just viewed as some effective stress energy test that's exactly like the source here. Then on the ends of the extra dimension, you have some localized energy densities. So you have some brains, and you have some tensions on these brains, which are labeled by V. Once you specify the structure of space-time and the sources that you have, you can solve the Einstein equations, and you get two independent equations. The solution turns out to be such that lambda has to equal this lambda 5 for the right upper form, so that you can identify that really just as a cosmological constant. And capital M here is just the five-dimensional Planck scale, the five-dimensional gravitational scale. The solution for the function A, which multiplies the four-dimensional space-time interval, is an exponential form. This is referred to as a walk factor. The constant K here is related to the dimensional parameters that are in the theory. And finally, a relationship between the brain tensions and this bulk energy density. The cosmological constant is required to be negative. So essentially, the Randall-Sundrum model is just a slice of ADS. So that's a brief explanation of what the model is. Now I just want to say a few words on why people not care, why they think it might be interesting. So the main reason people are interested in it is because it provides a candidate solution to the hierarchy problem. And that is, it enables you to generate different mass scales, or have different mass scales in the theory in a quantum mechanically stable way. So to see how that happens, you can consider a scale which is localized at one end of this extra dimension, the infrared end, or a TV frame. You give it some potential, where V naught here is mass parameter and potential. And then you want to look at what happens in the effective four-dimensional theory. So you integrate out over this extra dimension. You rescale the wave function to get the kinetic term right. And you find that the effective mass parameter in the 4D theory is scaled down relative to the input parameter that you put into the theory. So that's kind of the more interesting parts of the model, is that starting with input parameters which are all of the Planck scale, you can end up with parameters which are much less than the Planck scale. And given that that's what we observe in nature, we know that we have a weak scale, we know that we have a Planck scale, maybe there's other things we don't know. But this is certainly an interesting idea to consider that. So the value of the low energy scale is required to be about TeV if you want to explain electroweak symmetry breaking via this effective four-dimensional scaling. So that requires the length and cave about 35 or something there. Okay, so the setup would be that if you wanted to try and implement this feature within the context of the standard model, you would put the Higgs boson on this plane. And the simplest thing to try and do when you want to consider implementing the whole standard model in this scenario would be to put all of the standard model fields on the plane. When you do that, the only thing which would provide you with an indication that there is a dimension would be this, the Kluze-Klein structure associated with the graviton. And so even with all the standard model fields on the brain, it's in principle possible to determine that you're living in an extra-dimensional space due to these KK gravitons. In the Randall-Sundrum model, the Kluze-Klein excitations for a bulk field, for most of the types of fields anyway, tend to reside at the infrared end of the extra dimension. In particular, for the Kluze-Klein gravitons, they reside at the low energy end of the dimension. This is just because they have less mass there, so it's energetically favorable to be there. This means that the graviton excitations, if the load scale is order TeV, should be of order TeV as well, so that they would in principle be observable at the pliers. When you do that and you go to have a look at experimental constraints which arise on non-renormalizable operators in the model, you realize it's actually not consistent to put all of the standard model in the brain. And the reason to do so, for it not being consistent, is that essentially the non-renormalizable operators are no longer adequately suppressed. In the standard model, we assume a gauge symmetry, we assume a matter content, right, and all the operators that we can consistent with those things, and the ones which potentially give us trouble, things like flavage changing operators, neutrino mass operators, proton decay, we can just assume that the cutoff is large enough to suppress them. If everything's stuck at a TeV brain in the Randall-Sundrum model, you can't do that, because it turns out the cutoff gets warped down as well. So the cutoff that you have in the theory is also loaded for objects you write in the TeV brain. So you lose the explanation for a lot of the nice features of the standard model. So this is, I guess, a point where you start to go to the next step of complexity. So if you want to have things safe with regard to some of these effects, you have to start filling the gauge fields in the fervor of the central of the brain and putting them into the bulk.
But, I mean, when you say consistency, you don't mean consistency, you just mean it's not experimentally favored. Right? It's mathematically consistent.
It's consistent with the experiment. So, exactly.
And is it impossible to make it consistent with the brain? I mean, couldn't you just on the brain have conserved area number or put in a whole bunch of brain based?
That's right. You could add in principle extra symmetries.
Which you'd also use detect or something, but have people explored that now?
No, I can't think of anyone who's
just be like basically saying you can't write down these operators because of some global symmetry that you're putting by hand.
Yeah, so it'd be on the brain, it'd be like living in a world where the new physics is at a TeV scale, so you have a lot of constraints in that.
I think that in logic of dimensions now, most of the front proton decay operator is suppressed by the TeV stream, right?
That's right.
So it has the same problem with proton decay.
Right.
In this case, Artanya Hamadella, for instance, they introduced, as you said, from a higher discrete symmetry, that 12 or something like that, to suppress the constraints. And we
understand that. So, if you consider the fermions to be in the bulk, you also obtain additional molecule weak score. And the basic idea is that when you put a fermion in the bulk, it ends up having this bulk mass parameter. This parameter can be varied, and if you vary it from the range negative 1 to 1 in units of the perfect decay that I wrote before, the profile of the fermion within your extra dimension changes from being localized at one end to localized at the other end. So putting the standard model fields in the bulk gives you an additional way to try and additional mechanism to try and describe flavor beyond just building into the decal patterns. The kind of picture you would have to imagine if you wanted to address flavor without having it result from the decal couplings is you would need the top quarks to be localized towards the infrared end, so they would have a large coupling with the Higgs. You would need the lighter things to be localized at the other end, so they have a suppressed coupling. This is sort of the second appealing aspect of the Reynolds numbers model. So one, it can potentially explain the hierarchy problem. Two, it can give you a different way to view the flavor problem. It seems like a smiley. We've been discussing this over lunch. So maybe I should.
Could you just give me some basics as to why is the wave function for the right-handed top flat as opposed to the one for the...
That's just a particular value.
That's just a choice.
That's just a particular value, but it doesn't have to be flat. Like things.
Absolutely.
You can have and you can have it not flat, and most people actually don't have the right-handed top flat, and you can get from the top flat. So that's just meant to be...
Okay, so you just...
Represent. How do you, what do you tune to make that choice? Is it the coupling to the brain?
This mass, just the bulk mass.
Bulk mass.
Yeah. So essentially, you get profiles which are something like. The mass divided by the mass scale. So if you vary this mass. Plus and minus, you change the system localized.
But why does it want to do something special with the brain at all? It must be, is there any kind of coupling with the brain?
To get those profiles, that's not assuming any kind of coupling with the brain. But it is, so.
If you do the fermion jump condition of the brain, there must be some sort of boundary in there.
There's a boundary condition, definitely. Yeah. In order. I was going to say this later on, but maybe I'm not necessarily going to answer the question that you're asking. But the 5D fermions are effect-alike, and you have an all-fold symmetry acting to project out one of these things. That means that you have a symmetry that detects certain boundary conditions. When you combine the equation of motion of the profile with those symmetries, you get the boundary conditions. Which
essentially, one is even and one is not, so they're a little... vanishes the ones that are the derivative minus it's such that the exponential solution is kept basically. And so if you just do the quantum time composition, you find that that's a solution for the zero mode profile.
Yeah.
For one of the other, for one of the right. File components of the Fermi's direct spin.
So the equations of profiles are just something like that, and then one of them is off, so that the boundary one of them vanishes, and then that just gives you the boundary condition to break the other one. Okay, so this kind of picture doesn't explain flavor in the sense that it's not a completely fundamental theory that dictates the flavor we have in the world has to be exactly what it is. It explains it in the following sense. It's addressing it in the sense that in this framework you can take all the parameters of the model, you can write them down, they can all be order one, and you can generate a hierarchy of masses and you can angles like the exact geometry. Whereas in the standard model, if you take the parameters that we have, you can't do it with only one parameter. You have to have a hierarchy amongst the parameters to get that. So like perhaps it's not clear that we, in nature, we have to have order one parameters, but if that is the case, this is one way in which you can realize that. The specific values that you have to choose for these masses, or that you can choose to realize the structure, aren't dictated though. You actually have three options. So is this
probably, it's related to the previous question, but there is slightly more to that, right? That's the choice also of bounded conditions. Something that projects out a zero mode, say, for example, for the wave function as a total, versus the one that picks out the other. So in some sense, you know, all this unnaturalness that you have to do in standard model is hidden here in the choice of the bounded conditions.
So I'm not sure that, like the boundary conditions in some sense are just consistency conditions once you design a space-time to have this kind of structure. Like if you're working with the interval and it's derived from the normal bulk picture, any bulk field is going to have a transformation property under the all bulk symmetry. And then the only freedom that you have is choosing a sign which results in determining which handedness.
So it's just a discrete choice.
There's only a discrete choice, but it's actually not really a physical choice because it just determines whether your zero modes are left-handed or right-handed. and you can just choose them to be antiparticle or particle operators. So actually, some of the symmetry which gives you final zero modes isn't really a choice once you've set the structure of the space-time. Once you've just designed the Ramachandran model, that's not actually a choice. Not a physically important choice.
So in my sense, I mean, I would thought I can impose situation, the boundary condition for the fermions, so that the field has to vanish near the boundary, and that probably will project on the zero k-table and the lowest excitation being the first k-table that will change the spectrum. So you are telling me that is not centered along?
You can't do it for both handedness, because the bulk field has is vectorized, like that's left and right handed objects. So. And if you choose the boundary conditions, you have to make sure that the boundary conditions of the action vanish. And so that means there's a relationship between what the boundary conditions have to be for that kind of right kind of things. And so that's why then.
Yeah, you don't. I see. So if I.
The only way you can get
so
used to that statement is to have additional things that you put on the brains. And then the boundary conditions and the boundary variations also depend on what else is stuck at the brain. So if you give a mass for the fermion, if you give the fermion a mass, sorry, on the brain, on the story of the boundary conditions changes. But in the absence of adding fermions, that's ever false true. Okay, so depending on your point of view, you might think that was either a lovely scenario, but the dark side of the story is, as you're thinking of these sort of extensions, this thing, while you then have to run away, compare the construct you have with the experiment to see if the initially appealing features are actually consistent with what we know of the real world. There's a number of places where the Ramachandran models can get into trouble, and I'm going to describe in a little detail in a moment what these areas are, and then solutions tend to be you have to add more structure to make the whole thing work. Before I do that, I just want to say a couple of other things. So a lot of people are sort of adopting the point of view nowadays that the Ramachandran model isn't necessarily an extra dimensional thing. It's just some way to calculate some strongly coupled four-dimensional theory. And this is based on applying the ADS-CFT correspondence to the Ramachandran frameworks. And the conclusions people have arrived at is that if you apply this to these RS models, the RS model is basically equivalent to some strongly coupled large N SUE gauge theory plus 4D gravity. And there's a whole dictionary about what modifications the RS picture represents with regards to modifications of the 4D picture. So basically, a view a lot of people have now is that you're treating this as a way to model some strongly coupled four-dimensional dynamics, which in other which would otherwise be difficult to actually investigate. So some of the examples from this dictionary are, depending where you reside in this extra dimension determines whether you're mostly a composite or a fundamental object in the 4D theory. Things which are at the low energy end, if they're double functional localized, they're pure composite objects. And so the Higgs boson is some composite of this strong dynamics. Fermions, which are in the bulk that localize either towards one or the other end, there's some mixing between fundamentals and composites, and the extent to which they're fundamental is dictated by the extent to which they live up on end. So there's also...
Before you look at that slide, so the people that have this attitude, right, is there a picture in their mind that these are really, the Ramachandran is exactly the same thing as the CFT, and it's just how you choose to think about it, or do they think they're really different, and the Ramachandran is an approximation to what they really want to talk about, which is going to be different in some way, and there would be some... ultimately some observable if you could distinguish them.
I haven't seen anyone talking about observables that were distinguished before.
Really, it's just a question of taste whether you want to think that extra dimensions are
profoundly. Yeah, that's the impression I have. I'm reluctant to say exclusively that's the case, but
yeah.
Certainly in my experience I haven't.
So two things we know we need for strongly coupled theories is you need an approximate, mostly you need an approximate custodial SUQ. Okay. You also need a small S parameter. So you said there's this dictionary, and people actually worked out what sort of generic effects on the geometry correspond to both of those things?
So the answer on these that I'm going to mention some of that in a moment. So, yes, people put a dictionary and use it from a model building perspective to put certain ingredients into the RNS model to give you protection of the deep kernel, for example, before they.
So, you're just going to get to that?
What is the password?
Oh, it's just an arbitrary parameter. It's an oblique parameter.
So in the two frame Reynolds syndrome thing, you also need to stabilize that. So you have some. So I mean, I'm assuming that's all being done implicitly in everything you're saying. So.
Yeah, I haven't said anything about that.
And how does that affect? So you've got some other scalar there or something. How does that affect the same machines? That connection with. Because I would say, so first off, the forward effective theory, if you look on the brain, for the brain you're living on, would be gravity and this extra scale, and one or two extra scale fields. So is it those two extra scalar fields and then CFP, or are those somehow supposed to be part?
So I think, and I'm stretching my memory since I'm talking about stabilization a little bit, I think the extra excitations that you get from stabilizing the mode that's the fluctuation tends to reside up the paper end, and so it tends to be some object which is present in the CFT. So that's really all I know about the extent to which that, like how that extra degree of freedom enters into the dictionary. I'm not sure if I can put an answer to the question.
Yeah, I mean, just the cases where I've seen it more clearly worked out, like Gupta has a paper where he shows, you know, just a single brain case, you can calculate the 2-point function for gravity on this brain, and you show that's equivalent to what you get if you have that graviton interacting with the CFP and stuff. But that works really in the one brain case where you don't have this extra scalar.
Okay, so
it's not clear that we have that extra scalar. Is that part of the CFP or is that a separate thing that also?
So I believe that the scalar becomes part of the CFT, but I'm not sure of the specific calculations showing like the mapping between the effects. I'm not familiar with that part of the literature. The work and the views I have are all done pretty much within the context of the Reynolds syndrome side.
Essentially, though, if you put another field on the ball, it means you have some new operator in your CFP. So this operator, you put the scalar in the ball to stabilize the dimension. And this operator, it's like basically some vacuum expectation value that kind of breaks the scale in Reynolds and stabilizes the dimension. So that's kind of the interpretation.
Okay, so I've been talking about the hierarchy problem. From an experimental point of view, it's not necessarily clear that the full hierarchy problem between the weak scale and the front scale is something we have to address at this point in time. Maybe there's new physics and that means we should worry about the minimal hierarchies that might exist in nature. If you don't take the point of view that you want to explain the hierarchy between the weak scale and the plant scale, you still have to address presumably the dual hierarchy problem, which is obtained by demanding that non-renormalizable operators don't spoil the precision electroweak data. That requires the cutoff of the stone log to be about 10 TeV, and you would generally expect the Higgs mass to be roughly there. If you look at the flavor data, and assume we're one cut things for the non-renormalizable operators, the operators are only consistent with the data we have for a cutoff of about 10 to 10 to 3 TeV, depending on what we look at.
That's a very fuzzy statement, though, that's a little apparent. Because what anyone does when they make that statement, which I really don't like,
yeah.
Is they always just take all the operators that would contribute to the precision data fix, and then they fix all of them to zero except for one. And then they fit for that one. Because otherwise, you get this huge matrix with unknown correlations with the underlying physics, and you don't know what to do. So it's really, there really isn't much to the statement that it has to be KTV. Because you know that if there's new physics, it'll contribute to more than one operator.
Yeah.
And there'll be correlations amongst the operators. It'll project out some area that Skiba, the matrix paper by Skiba and Hang. It won't be that it's going to have to be a TV.
like that's extremely misleading.
Those statements are derived under the sort of simplest ways that you can study the effects of these operators.
But it's not just the simplest, like it's like an inconsistent picture. Because the picture is that you have new physics that only contributes to one operator. Which you know is not the case.
So what's the more sophisticated?
The problem is you get this huge matrix with unknown correlations, and then you can't make a conclusion. So that's why people don't, because if you could say something and then other people say, well, you can't say anything, you don't listen to other people.
We're going to be doing great outs in physics. You get not one operator, you get, you know, a shitload of operators.
You get a whole pattern,
and then six of them join this thing that they get the bound from, and so they could each be two, and there's six of them, and that gave them a 10.
Okay.
And so then you don't really know there's a scale in your problem, which is 10
at all. There's really no support to the statement.
So it can be much higher.
It can be much lower.
It could be lower. So the thing is, even if you thought, you might not have thought 10 was a higher peak. Yeah, that's like 2 pi or something. But even if you did, it's not clear that you had actually even have that.
So in either case, if you take the flavor data, then you are going to want the cutoff to be larger than that. I'm not going to be going on with a little hierarchy. We're talking about the scales that people talk about, and I understand what you're saying. I agree.
If they could deliver knowledge to the operators, I mean, from the effective field theory, you can say that the whole of operators are relevant. You could separate them some,
but I mean, come on. The picture that really gives you something like that 10 TV is really the picture you set everything else to zero, and you just fit one operator, which is, I mean. If you want to argue about that being a little harpy, you should really argue about what the hell is the underlying new physics that does that. It's totally crazy. It doesn't make any sense.
Okay, so I should get moving here. So what I wanted to, the statement I wanted to make really with that previous slide was just that there are perhaps lower energy scales that one might want to consider as being the cutoff of the same model theory than the scale. This would be true if you had a GUT scenario. Now, the little Randall-Sundrum model is a particular modification of the Randall-Sundrum model, and I just want to briefly introduce this before I start discussing some of the experimental data situations. And in a little Randall-Sundrum model, you abandon trying to explain the hierarchy between the wet scale and the front scale by this five-dimensional looping, and instead you assume that the UV brain is consistent with the wet flavor cutoff. So you have a UV scale here of about 10 to the 3 TeV. Now, this means you're no longer trying to include four-dimensional gravity, so you have to have the boundary conditions such that the graviton doesn't have a zero mode. There are still KK modes for the graviton, which corresponds to bound states of the CFD. And it also corresponds to having a larger N in your SUN type theorem on the four-dimensional side. So the reasons people consider this is, once you start looking at the RS model and you realize there's problems, you think about ways to modify it and to address them. You can take the view that this is one sort of modification you make. The other view you can have is maybe, it's really in the end an experimental question. If this warping site picture is responsible for the generation of the weak scale in nature, it would really be an experimental question to determine what scale has been warped out. So you'd want to know what the signals would be if you'd be able to differentiate. Now there's some of the places where the RS model gets into trouble. The first one I'll just briefly mention is the oblique parameter. And that's essentially the contribution from new physics to the two-point functions for gauge bosons. So you can parameterize this in a way that is standard in the literature for heavier new physics. And in the RS type models, the level contributions that you get as a result of mixing between quasi-quantum excitations of the weak bosons and the weak bosons themselves after electronic symmetry break occurs take this kind of form. They depend on this KL, which is going to be different between the little Randall-Sundrum model and the Randall-Sundrum model. Experimentally, we know these quantities to be bound of order to the negative one. Okay, so.
What was CB in the previous slide?
What was
C sub B? The key parameter.
Yeah, I think that was a C sub theta, which was just the Weinberg angle. Yeah. All right, so if you take the KK scale of the gauge bosons to be about 5 TeV and compare the oblique parameters in these two models, you find that the RS model gets into trouble with the T parameter for exactly the kind of reasons that you were thinking of before. The little radial Sundra model does better. The T parameter comes out to be all right. So the difference between the two models is the tree level effects that control better in the little radial Sundra model. The loop effects, the loop contributions to these parameters, it turns out, are not really differentiated between the two frameworks, and there also ends up being some color-dependent effects. And the end observation is that the KK scale for the minimal models with these kind of pitches has to be about 10 TeV. The name of the game here for these couple of slides really is sort of the following. But you want the KK scale for the gluons to be, say, roughly 3-2 TeV if you want to completely explain the origin of the weak scale in a way which doesn't have some sort of hierarchy and some sort of tuning built into it. If you start making the KK scale higher, you need there to be a larger amount of tuning to keep the Higgs boson mass lighter. So you really want to aim, if you want to say you're solving the hierarchy problem completely, you want to end up with a pitcher in your RS view which has a KK scale of about 2-3, that sort of size TV. Now, a little bit higher, you're talking about a small percentage of tuning, and that becomes a sort of aesthetic question. But there's really an analogy between the SUSY models here in that in a SUSY model, you know the hierarchy problem is explained if all the superparticles are at a certain scale. Once you push them up higher and higher, you still sort of explain it, but you have some discrepancy, then you get a question to what extent is this point tuned now. So that's the same sort of story that plays out in the variable Sundra models. So I just said then that the oblique parameters aren't...
So just to get a sense as to why T is so different, T is basically the W and Z mass, right? So what's the classical physics that gives you T in these models? What breaks the custodial symmetry? Why is it better to have a shorter Randall syndrome or lower scale for Randall syndrome for that parameter?
Yeah, so it's... Yeah, to tell you the truth, I'm really stumped if I try and say exactly why. Like, if the pitches that give rise
to... It's going to reproduce the standard model. It's just be one that's going to have more suppressed corrections.
Well, it's true that T is the thing that is basically, it's a dimension 2 term, which is a very gauge group. It's a gauge boson mass. So it kind of sounds right that the bigger scale is worse because it's kind of going to give a bigger contribution to it. But I don't quite see exactly how you calculate at the classical level the W boson masses, I guess. They're all in the bulk in this picture, right?
Yeah.
So it's something to do with the profiles for the W versus the Z. And is that controlled by the coupling of the fermions, where is the Higgs with that?
So the Higgs is the Higgs is stuck at fermion from TeV frame, and then the electroweak gauge bosons are bulk objects, and then you derive some expression for the profiles prior to electroweak symmetry breaking, and then they'll have. Symmetry breaking, and then there'll be some mix between the massless object, which is the standard model object, and the KK excitations.
Yeah.
And it must just be that the act of doing that isn't equivalent to 22 seconds. Yeah. All right, so the standard way to control the T parameter in models is to have some custodial symmetry built into the theory. In the standard model, the Higgs potential has this extent symmetry, it's actually 2 squared, and that acts as a custodial symmetry. If you look at the ABS CFT stuff, people realize that demanding that the CFT psi, the 4D psi, had this custodial symmetry corresponded to having an extended gauge symmetry in the bulk. So an additional degree of complexity that you need to include introduce custodial symmetry was to extend the bulk gauge group from being SU2 to SU2 squared. So
can I ask my question in this context then? Because in the standard model you would have said that the custodial symmetry comes because I think of the doublet as being 4 real fields, and so there's no 4 that rotates them. And then the potentials for free invariant under that, given that it was quartic. And so then the gauge couplings are invariant for the SU2 sector. And so I don't see how any of that would change in the brain. If you have the Higgs in the brain and it's got a quarter coupling, quarter potential in the brain, sounds like it's going to be automatically a four invariant. So somehow it must be a coupling of the bulk cage fields to the brain. So is that what's breaking like the Stigler function?
Well, I think it has to be. Like, as you say, the Higgs potential is still a four-dimensional object.
So it's not this. The SU2 is safe, but somehow the U1 hypercharge is more dangerous because there's a full Clebsch-Klein tower of them now rather than just the one that you have in the center point. So I guess the gauge coupling has got dimension to the next dimension. Okay, no, I think I.
So in both of the pictures, the RS and the RS, if you modified the whole gauge symmetry to have these extended issues of symmetry as well, the K-K scale. There's also trouble with the vertex, like the Z-bos on a couple of the big points. And that results from the fact that the top part has to live close to the where Higgs lives if you want to generate them for that. That would be something that's. The top class comes in a double with the bottom, so both the bottom and the top live up that end. As I said before, the KK excitations of objects tend to reside at that end also. So the bottom part has sizable couplings to some of the excitations. So there's a couple of ways in which this modifies the ZD-V-bar vertex. And the result is that between the two scenarios, the little random sundry model fares a little bit. So in both frameworks, so you have to be careful with these additional effects, but that's really not the dominant. People would realize that the RS model can also be modeled by changing representations such that some of those couplings to KK states aren't present. But the main problem actually comes in these models from a strongly coupled gauge bosons. So the KK excitations are the gluon, the things that get you in the most trouble. And the CP violating from the chaos sector is where you get in the most trouble. Essentially, the KK, the flavor changing effects can occur at tree level, and this is always going to be dangerous. So initially, when this little Randall-Sundrum model was constructed, it seemed that it was nicer compared to the Randall-Sundrum because you had a better chance of explaining the weak scale and still being consistent with the flavor changing effects. But since then, people have found the operators and studied things more carefully and realized that actually they're both sort of in trouble for about 20 TeV, up to about 20 TeV. That statement should perhaps be clarified. That's assuming that you're trying to explain flavor as well as solve the hierarchy problems. And people have shown there are regions in parameter space where if you allow some of the Yukawas to have variance, then you can get the scale back down to 3 TeV. So other people have said we still want to explain flavor without having any Yukawa hierarchies, and they take the view that you can add a flavor symmetry. And they seem to be arguing that you can still get it down. But it's kind of a messy thing in that every time someone controls one effect, someone else finds something else.
So you change the initial bounds, you have 8 3 TeV. Those are just wrong.
Yeah, there was.
How were they wrong? People were screwing up by a factor of 4 and they didn't notice?
Well, they're model dependent, right? Because it depends on the flavor couplings on the brain.
Yeah, so I haven't paid attention to the specific. I think it was just some operators that were initially expected to be suppressed due to wave function overlaps weren't as suppressed as people had thought, and they dismissed them in analysis at the start. And then when someone else looked at them more carefully, and they realized, oh, hold on, this one isn't suppressed because of this thing.
They can't be suppressed at all. it must be that the flavor changing operators are the ones that have to be more suppressed. And so if you build flavor changing, protection for flavor changing effects into your brain, then those bounds will go away for free. And it puts the fine scale at the be as well as you like. And that must be the models where you can get away with it, right? Mm-hmm. And so it sounds like they're getting a bound under the assumption that there's nothing protecting flavor symmetry on the brains. And so then the Clebsch-Klein exchange can give you flavor changing, which is going to give you a stronger bound than you would have had from the exchange.
Okay, so that's all like you said before, really. The only extra thing I was just going to say there was that hinging all of those things normally just proton decay either, so these models generally have a proton decay problems also. But I guess you can just assume some very unknown things So in the next part I'm just going to talk a little bit about some, I guess, more exotic extensions of the Rand-Sundrum model. And as I've said, there's a bunch of problems, and some people are interested in considering bidimensional versions of these Rand-Sundrum scenarios. You can motivate them by saying maybe you can find some solution to some Rand-Sundrum problem. Again, experimental choice.
So the way of my kind of there are other hierarchy problems in particle physics, I can think of neutrino mass, electron mass. So there are other, is there any reason that you don't think about those in this context?
So in the specific examples you gave then, so there's not a technical hierarchy problem with electron mass, for example, because there's an additional symmetry present in the standard model and in these models when you send the electron mass to zero. And this means that basically the masses are protected by a symmetry, so the corrections are proportional to the masses. And the neutrino case, well, we can if neutrinos are Dirac, then you have the same story. And if neutrinos are not Dirac, then there's the seesaw mechanism that means people don't worry so much about neutrinos because basically if neutrinos are later on, they're going to come from a dimension 5 operator of that form. So that's going to be 1 over some mass scale. But what I was saying before is that if you have these scenarios, that suppressing mass scale can be lower depending on exactly how you find the gain. So that means the neutrino mass and in principle starts to become too large. In practice, what it means is you have to have the neutrinos level as really towards the ultraviolet end, so that have a really tiny overlap with the Higgs boson.
Is that another fine tuning?
It's not a tuning in the sense that it can still be realized with the values of order one. So I guess you can just say why. Like a question that's not really interesting in these kind of models is why electrons sort of lighter so much than quarks, for example. If you just sprinkle randomly, then it's not clear that there should be differentiation between quarks and electrons by structures. But you can realize the mass hierarchies without tuning search. So the other reason to maybe possibly consider pressure dimensional constructs is to, if you take this AGCFT kind of thing seriously, that sort of implies your modeling this RS as some approximation to some string type thing, and there might be these extra dimensions around that these particles may or may not be able to live in. One way that you can extend the Rand-Sundrum scenario is to go from a warp spacetime to a multiple warp time. And once you go to 6 dimensions, there's a difference between the metric that you would write down in the conformal version versus a non-conformal extension of the RS metric. And you can play a game where you generalize the RS results precisely by having these bulk slice sleeves, these brains which chop off the fundamental space that you're dealing with, and have a non-factorizable metric. And the solution plays out exactly like you would expect, in that you can get solutions which are warp factors. And there's tunings require relationships between the bulk and brain energy densities. And also, in these particular cases, you can't have a pure cosmological constant. So the effective sources you might then have to represent some new physics, which also we have to be investigating. That kind of framework can provide a UV completion of sorts for little Rand-Sundrum type models. So in the little Rand-Sundrum model, you're no longer inputting planescale parameters, but if it's embedded into some multiple warp thing, you can input planescale parameters and you can generate both the sort of UV scale, the little Rand-Sundrum slice, and the weak scale thing. So the idea would be that the little Rand-Sundrum model is confined to some five-dimensional slice or some five-dimensional thing, and the Higgs boson would live at the infrared end of both of these and playing the same games as you do in the Rand-Sundrum model.
Stability analysis here probably is much more messy, right? So my guess is that to make a stable integration, small for the world, it's very difficult. has it been ever discussed?
No, it hasn't been done. I mean, but you would guess it's going to be more complicated.
Well, I don't know a single example. I would say that will always be something.
Well, an example of a code mention two thing, which has got a disability thing, hasn't done is when it's or just not retained right, this is when it's spherical and there's two brains of the event in a supergravity framework, or in a gravity framework. In that case, you can have fluxes supporting the extra dimensions that will help you still. I don't know any other people use those for models.
This metric, it looks just like ADS plus this one, because you got two exponential z to the minus k1 y1, but I could just read them. Minus k2 y2, but I could just read it on y to combine the y1, k1, y1, k2, y2, and then do a rotation in y1, y2 direction.
Yeah.
And then I would have thought it was just ADS. And that would sound like a stable configuration. And then
you still have to deal with the size of the S1, right? You have to still deal with the size.
Yeah, you have a size of S1, which would like to shrink. So you have,
yeah, but I'm more worried. That's okay, but I'm more worried about the fact that you then, if that's the geometry, then you're putting the brains in at some strange angle in the y1, y2 direction. It doesn't sound like it's stable as well as the S1.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. It's a concern.
It's sort of, yeah. In the natural coordinates, the brains are identical, and that's usually not the same.
Yeah. So, I won't keep the time, I'll move on to the... So that picture was just showing the way the lure is on the model being embedded in the brain of Sanders Butt framework.
In the tutorial pictures, I remember back in the mists of time, when people were doing string model building, they looked at orbital folds on Tori, and one of the ones that were nice were the ones that were you had Z3s in them, because in phenomenology you're looking for threes everywhere. And so they live off the fact that there was threes in the Z3, the two fixed points and things. People looked at, in this case, if you had a toroidal, two of toroidal extra dimensions, like for an overfold, which is more of a Z3 overfold rather than a combination of Z2s.
So people have certainly looked at more exotic toroidal overfolds, but mostly in the context of the ADD type stuff. Like I can't remember exactly skins in through at the top of my head, but I've seen so many different ones that I can't remember all the ones I've seen, because there's a whole bunch of different two-dimensional ones. I've thought a little bit about whether you can sort of have walking in those that kind of question is all being tied into the thoughts I've had on this thing. It's not clear whether or not you can, to me, whether you can come to me. Yeah, certainly no one's done it. So. Exactly, like, how does the Z3 help on the number of generations? Do you know about that?
Maybe remember the number of generations was coming out that way, and it was to do with in the orbit and the string thing, that, you know, there's all these topological relationships amongst all the quantities. And it was more or less like in a cloudy outer space that your index theorem behind the board that was giving you, in which you were making choices so that you got three as the index. So you're doing two copies of all your zero modes. And the orbit fold was more or less doing that, and it was the Z3 construction, so I filled that in.
Yeah, so I think it would be interesting to think about if any of those results can be applied in this kind of different context.
I think you're right, it was done in this extra large dimension by every time Gary Schuh in all days. So they were doing these pre-enfold constructions. But exactly as you said, it's very difficult to introduce walking set. You know, you have tons of moduli and you can come up with more or less realistic even particle. And it's a three, well, I mean, it's a oriented box.
How much are you talking about? Because of the arbitrary output of torus in the context of intersecting frames. ADS 6 space is better when they introduce the multiple intersecting frames and impose a discrete symmetry.
How can you get ADS 6 in space here?
But I just, because he's talking about ADS space, I don't know about
it. I don't think you can get ADS.
Just to play about ADS 6.
So some people look at the ADS.
Okay, so the last thing I'll just briefly talk about is the Linux 106 model. As said before, there's this AES CFT stuff, and people have sort of started wondering, well, if you, again, I'll drop this picture, should you be concerned with ES5 floating around? And the first step in that direction is to consider just having this one there, see what you can learn, see whether it's going to be fruitful or interesting to proceed any further. So this is exactly what the picture that you were describing before, and you're right, it can be the picture that's going to join you as well. So I guess one could just be concerned about whether or not it could work, be realistic, once you include the additional dimensions, but one could also ask if you can address problems with that scene as well. So I'll just run through quickly the different types of standard fields and what the consequences are of considering them as fields within this extended space or structure versus just the space or structure.
I'm sorry. Why are we talking about this? Why can't you do Kalu's quantum reduction of the circle? I mean, if the circle is somehow what you're going to assume is stabilized, right? So why can't you do KK reduction and then you're back to a standard Randall sum, which potentially is from an additional bunch of people?
That's exactly what was going to happen. Okay, so I think the only complication is, I guess, it's just burning because as you go home, the objects change. But what you said is exactly right. In the RS model, you have some profiles which are vessel functions describing the gauge bosons that have order one. The masses roughly of that kind of scale walk down relative to the curvature. If you add this extra dimension, exactly as you're saying, you're going to have cross-size dimension, extra dimension, you integrate over that sixth dimension. That's how you do a tower of objects in the 5D theory. The way that tower manifests itself is that the order of the vessel function changes for each member of the tower. Only the one that would be the usual RS one will have a massless mode, that will be the standard model field. The KK towers of the exotic towers, the exotic fields that you have in the bulk or the additional ones that you have, also start at roughly the same scale as what the standard model fields KK tower starts at, because of the way this, actually mentioned, this extra label manifests itself. And that means that not only do you have more states, but you have more states all at similar energies. So you get a lot more states that are going to contribute to processes that you would be worried about potentially using the RS framework.
That's not clear to me. I mean, you still have a freedom of pretty much setting up the S1 to supply power any way you want. Why that has to be matched to the KK power in AES? I'm just saying that there will be a zero node, right? So it will be a single field. But then the rules of quantum modes coming from a circle I can make as heavy as I want. So I don't understand your observation that you're saying that the rules of quantum states will come from AGS like Randall.
So you can only start making them heavier than the kind of scales I've just been talking about if you shrink the radius to be smaller than Planck scale lengths.
Yes.
And so I'm assuming that you don't go beyond Planck scale lengths. If you allow it to be only as small as Planck scale lengths, then the states come in at TeV energies in the 4D theory. And that's the point I'm making.
Okay,
if you want to let it shrink below the Planck scale, then that's okay. Then exactly as you suspect, you're getting rid of the extra dimension in effect in the second. But if you say that these extra dimensions there, you don't know what's going on beyond the Planck scale at all. And you whether it's size B only as small as the Planck scale,
because you already introduced the hierarchy from the Planck scale.
Okay, so
just make sure I got that. So you've got this Kluge-Klein tower in a circle, and then you've got the ADS states, and you start seeing the Kluge-Klein stuff from the circle at the warp scale or the low energy TV scale.
Yeah.
And that's regardless of as long as the circle is bigger than the Planck scale, it's always true that that's where it kicks in. And is that just you're looking at the zero mode in that direction warp, or is the whole tower appearing at that scale, the warp down scale?
Say the last part again.
So if I just added the zero mode in the sixth dimension, then it's like having a scale of the only five dimensions, and I can imagine that then it's close to finding what you're going to do with the graviton bit. But if I look at the massive Kluge-Klein towers, so I take the fifth one up or something in the circle, and I look at its lightest state, from the ADS point of view, is it coming in as a
four-dimensional particle whose mass is some five times, say, the warp scale? Is that how it works?
Yeah, so the way it comes in is you look at the momentum in the sixth dimension, it acts as an effective mass for the five-dimensional object.
Yeah.
And then...
Oh, and then it's a mass.
Yeah, so it's just...
What is the point number on the...
There isn't a quantum number unless you put all the fields in the bulk and then figure out what exactly is going to be. That hasn't been done because there would only be a conserved quantum number, like for the symmetry would only correspond to some conserved quantum number if all the fields are focused on the whole in the bottom. So that sort of rotations around the circle work with the circle and the one dimension system.
Sure. But there will be a U1, I think he's right, there will be an addition of U1. It's just you choose not to look at it. But if you do carefully take a reduction besides non-scalar,
is the question you're asking on scalar loads associated with the bulk?
No, very old association. There is a U1 something in the bulk. And the question is, what is how specifically the boundary work? So, what field work? He's thinking in terms of a high dimensional model, right? If you take a high dimensional model, whenever you have a circular compactification, there will be scalars.
Associated with the graviton.
Right. Associated with the high dimensional gravity. But then on top of that, there will be a vector mode. There will be a U1. So every time you have a circle, if I think of this as if I were to sort of think about uplifting it, or thinking about if we have a six dimensional gravity, there will be just a U1 coming from six dimensional gravity. Okay. I think he's asking what's the effect of that you want?
Yeah, so do you actually have an actual U.S. between your field network? I mean, that corresponds to the power isometry coming from the
assumption. Okay, so I guess the simple sense of here is that a complete thing and over many degrees hasn't been determined because it's really only a stage of determining whether it's even viable to consider any ingredients.
Okay.
So I can't answer that.
Oh, that's fine. So just we'll just send a lot of particles carries the 0 quantum number into that solution. So
it will not couple the standard model fields, you know, as long as they need.
Yeah,
they will not couple to 0 quantum. So
we have to know though, because they get mix, right? Even though they're neutral, you get a mixing in the kinetic.
So there was a KK model of gravity, so there will be some mixing something like that.
Right.
Okay, So the story with scalars, bulk scalars, is exactly the same.
Yeah. Well, sorry. Yeah. So the reason I asked whether there is systemic theory on the field theory side is because I thought there may be systemic effects that may break the isometry. So that's what I found.
Well, it's very difficult to pick each one. So maybe waiting, unless you need to use some.
I mean, you may break it as some isometry effects that I don't know.
So the story with the bulk scalar is exactly the same as what I had with the vector there. The problem with the bulk scalar though is further compounded because it turns out that the bulk scalar can't be kept at order 10 to 2 GeV energy is the widest mode of all the scalar without introducing an additional tuning. So the standard model gives either has to be a 4D particle localized at some point in this 6D space, or it can in principle be a 5D field that's propagating in the circle but confined to the additional dimension. So just before I say something about fermions, I'll just recap a little bit about the 5D fermions, but essentially I've settled this before, the 5D fermions are vector-like. The boundary conditions are dictated here by the orbital construction, it's selecting one chirality because they're implemented by the fly metrics, and so you're able to get a chiral zero node in the case. I'm in the process at the moment of figuring out what happens to the fermions in the RS6 type scenario, and it seems to me that you can't get a chiral zero node. So fermions in six dimensions with the spinner has to have eight components, but in six dimensions there exists an operator change units with all the six dimensional gamma matrices. So you can define a chirality operator in six dimensions. The chirality operator in six dimensions has nothing to do with 4D chirality, it only projects it out half of these objects, which are labeled by plus or minus. So the six dimensional fermion has six dimensional chirality, this has these two units there. If you go to implement the orthofold symmetry that's operating in the random sundering dimension of this thing, these objects are not eigenstates. They're only eigenstates if you have a complete vector of that field. So the fermions appear to have a mixed parity, and those seem to you can't get chiral zero moves. So fermions don't seem to work.
Do you have only one or reverse spectrum?
Yeah, you can consider going to more complicated, like all the polymer torus or something.
Two orbit findings to work.
And that's sort of, I guess, that's something I'm thinking about at the moment. It also appears, something I was just realizing yesterday, that there's, you seem to be familiar with some of the Shapshaki work, and in their approach, they've gone from considering this warp dimension being on an orthofold to maybe it's being arbitrary interval, and you're looking at the general boundary conditions that are consistent with variation of the action. If you take that view in this kind of framework, you can choose boundary conditions which are parity selecting and will make the chirality selecting and make the orthofold, the action variations vanish. So it seems that if you take the interval picture, you can select the chirality. But then a weird thing happens when you do that, because it seems that each member of the... So a 6D fermion will have momentum in the sixth dimension, and that will give rise to a tower of massive fermions in the 5D theory. But we said before that in the 5D theory, a massive fermion still can have a massless chiral zero. Now, if you choose boundary conditions that are consistent with the variation of the action, but not necessarily those that correspond to all of our boundary conditions, you can get chiral zero modes which are massless for each member of that 5D tower. So if you choose one set of boundary conditions, you get no chirality. If you choose another set of boundary conditions, it appears, at least at this stage, that you get profiles, if I use the conformal coordinate, which are labeled by some quantum number corresponding to the momenta in the additional dimension. So one set of boundary conditions gives you an infinite set of massless chiral modes. Another set of boundary conditions gives you no chiral. Seems to be a strange result, certainly different.
You have different C values for each mode.
Yeah, so set A is like the label corresponding to the momentum in the sixth dimension. So each mode in the sixth dimension would have a slightly different profile, but each be chiral massless.
So is the RS6 just A is 5 times S1?
Yeah.
So you have all the different follow
the A
is 5. S1 you have.
Just leaving it in the line, but you could consider like all the following tolerance.
It's certainly true that if you do a sphere rather than toroid, then you can get four dimensional chiral fermions.
But in this context, what ingredients are like I'll be interested in having a talk with you about sphere
on
a sphere, so you can get chiral fermions in certain frameworks. Like exactly what those ingredients are.
Yeah, there you don't even need frames, but it's you're living off the fact that if you have fluxes in the extra dimensions and there's again an index here on that, that when you go to four dimensions and integrate it with the extra dimensions completely, you can get chiral four dimensional.
See the standard claims that I come across in the future are that you can't get massless chiral waves in the fermions in M4 process 2. And the argument is people say that you don't get massless modes on the speed of the fermions. So I don't know whether there's some
of the reasons, I think, because it's in the early 80s, Witten had this argument against chiral fermions, and the sixth dimensional example was the counterexample. And it's a counterexample because the fluxes change the solutions. So you have to have a Maxwell field in the two dimensions. So pure gravity couldn't do it, but you could do it with Maxwell.
I guess that's the fluxes.
Yeah.
Okay, so the generalizations of those sort of comments, observations to the S5 case can be made, but I don't know if that's on the spin sharp. But as I say, I've sort of dragged Gerald through the model over there and talked about where the bounds are and stuff like that. I just want to give a bit of an overview for what the state of play is there. I guess you would certainly say that the state of play is similar to SUSE in that. It's a simple idea. When you go to implement certain management, it's completely realistic. You can get yourself into trouble pretty quickly. So at the end of the day, the big question is going to be, what are we going to see in the OHC? You know, I can show some lights on to whether any of these pitches have anything to do with the way the voice scale is stabilized or something else, maybe some other strong dynamics which you can't model by an OHC model. So that's it for the talk today. Thanks for listening.
Any questions?
So is there a model like the MSSM which kind of passes all the tests even though it might not be pretty?
I'm not expert enough in the MSSM to answer
that. No, but I said, is there one model that you could take and say, well, it satisfies all the bounds?
I would be surprised if you couldn't find something in the sense that there's 100 parameters.
Yeah.
And like, the question really is, can you satisfy all the bounds and have the objects light enough to still explain the hierarchy with zero tuning?
Yeah.
I'm not sure that I can accept. I think everyone, like, it's a question of basis to extent what you say. Like, there's certainly no one thing that does it. People study some subset of some models based on some assumption that there's some parameters and some scale and trace it down and direct constraints.
Yeah, so on this side, it sounds like it'd be nice to have a couple models which really put a little hierarchy aside. You said that, you know, so here's something which does everything I want, and you test it to death. So it's simple enough that you can actually work better than you.
Yeah, and that's what it sort of moving towards. The complexity at the moment is adding sort of more of the ingredient which has been explored in more detail, and then it's adding flavor symmetries to generate the masses in a way that is also protecting, for example, the CP1. It's not, people are still sort of, there's no one approach to it, and the reason why probably there won't be one approach to it is because it depends on what you're demanding of the model. If you demand that the model gives you flavor completely without having any of the flavor built into the UCARWAS, then the constraints on the model are really different to if you allow the flavor to be partially built into the UCARWAS. And so the extent to which people say you can or cannot get something that really does the job is determined by your space with regards to the way you generate flow. But people seem to have arrived at, like, in the last 6 months or so, certain models which seem to address all the problems that I've set here.
Any other questions? Let's thank Christian.